This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It was an interesting week at work. Lots of things going on this week. But that's okay. Jesus is good. All is well. All is well. We just had a lot of interesting things crop up, and there's filings being done because it's that time of the year with the government, and so there's things coming up with that, and they are expanding the number of people that are running on some of the systems that we're working on, and so, yeah, there's lots of excitement. Ta-da-ta-da! And it was the end of the month for one of the new expense reporting systems that I was writing, and we had to make some changes, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's all good. It's all good. The young lady who lives with us, we've been having some conversations about the role of fear in our lives and how we combat the role of fear. And so I was sharing some of my experiences with her, and, you know, we're talking. And so it's good. It's good. It's good. Everything's pottering along at work, though. All looks good. There's just a lot to be done. We're going one step at a time. Because that's all you can do. And it is extremely complex, but that's okay. One step at a time. Always. The writing's going fine. I'm actually up around chapter 26. I missed yesterday writing because I had to bill for the month because it was the 31st. So I had to bill for the month, and my writing time is short on Wednesday anyways. And then I had a big conversation with the young lady who lives with us. And so that cut a little more time out of it. And, you know, by the time, and I knew we were going to be doing some big stuff today. So by the time I got done with all that, about 10 o'clock was rolling around, and I just thought, you know, you should just go to sleep. Just go to sleep. And so I went ahead and just went on. I actually had some breakfast today, even though I wasn't getting together with a friend, because I thought, this is a big enough day, you just need yourself some oatmeal. So I've got some of that steel-cut oatmeal downstairs that I eat occasionally, and so I just made some of that and munched on that today. So I just had a little more energy because I wanted to be in tip-top form. But that was it, so I'm going home. Get to eat when I get home. So yeah, I think the book is going fine. It's always interesting to me as I move through it how things resolve down, because I know the scenarios I want to get to, and then as I'm working on it, I have some of those scenarios I then say, nope, I guess we're not doing that, and I move that out of the way, and I move another piece into place. And it's a really, really fascinating process, and I love it. By the way, for those of you who are interested in socks, I found a website called Bold Socks, boldsocks.com, and they were actually running some clearance stuff, and I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but I think I've bought 7 pairs of socks from them at this point, and normally they're like $12, $18 a pair, and I've been getting them for $6, $7 a pair, and if you order $25 worth of stuff, it's free shipping, so it's like, hey, it's good. And I've gotten some compliments on the socks, and they're good. Yay! So I like them. I like them. There's this part of the socks are something, Statement Socks, I think, Statement Socks, and I need to check into them more, because they like do this thing where if for every pair of socks that you buy, they like provide drinking water for, and supposedly like 100 cups of drinking water per sock you buy or something like that. I don't know. Anyways, you know, if you're into that type of thing, at least in your purchases, you can do some good at the same time. So that's all good. Book is good. Food is good. Oh, I'm going to start sprouting stuff. Broccoli sprouts. They say broccoli is really good for you. but they say broccoli sprouts are even gooder. So I decided this week I'm starting to sprout broccoli. Because I checked into it, and I've got a buddy who does it, and he said it's not that hard. It's like sauerkraut, you know? It's just not that hard to do. And so I'm going to go ahead and start that up. I've got my sprouting lids coming in. I've got my broccoli seeds coming in. And I have plenty of wide-mouth mason jars, quart size. So I'm just going to give this a try and see how this goes. It just doesn't seem that hard. You get a mason jar, you put in 2 tablespoons of broccoli sprouting seeds, and cover them with water, leave them sit in water for 12 hours, you dump the water out, put the sprouting lid thingy on there. Well, I guess you put that on ahead of time. Dump out the water, then after you leave them sit for 12 hours, every 12 hours you dump out the water, you rinse it out, you dump out the water, you turn it up on its side, you know, so excess water drains out. Keep them moist, not too wet, so they don't mold. Ta-da! Supposedly like 4 or 5 days later, they're actually sprouting. And then 6 or 7 days later, they have little leaves. You put them up in the windowsill, let them get a little sun. They green up. Time to eat. Good eats. So we're going to give it a try. It'll be fun. Anyways, this week I had several other things marked in my little bookmarks for the podcast. I went through and cleaned out a bunch of that stuff. I thought, excuse me, I am never going to do a talk on this stuff. It's been sitting in my bookmarks for years. Forget it. Just cleaned out. Kept a bunch of stuff, though. But then I came across one of those bookmarks, and I thought, you know, I don't think I've done a podcast on this. At least I didn't check. This may be a rerun. I don't think I have. I had it bookmarked, but I'm pretty sure I never did. So, having had a conversation this past week with a friend who was in the midst of troubling times and had well-meaning Christians providing prepackaged, standard, I will go so far as to say non-thinking responses to the situation, I came across this and I thought, you know, maybe we should just talk about this because there may be other situations that come up that people might be benefit from realizing you should just kind of slow down sometimes from just sort of spouting off the standard responses to things. And specifically, this article I was reading was from several years ago, but it concerned Ephesians chapter 5. Because many people look at Ephesians chapter 5 as being the chapter that's supposed to tell us how husbands and wives should interact. Except it has been my observation that we often only quote 1 or 2 verses out of this chapter, and we just sort of ignore the rest of the stuff. In fact, when my daughter and son-in-law got married, they were talking about their vows, and we started talking about this chapter, and I said, you know, it's a great chapter in terms of what God expects out of marriage. And so we actually worked and built vows on Ephesians chapter 5. Not surprisingly, for those who have actually read the chapter, Alan, my son-in-law's vows, were far longer than my daughter's vows. Because we like to quote the wife's responsibilities, but then we don't necessarily get around to quoting the husband's responsibilities. And just that as a starting point, and then we'll go farther later, we a lot of times forget to quote the verse that comes before the wife's responsibilities, which is something along the lines, submit yourselves one to another. So Paul, as he starts into this passage, begins with, you should all be submitted one to another. So there's not any clear dominance. And then he says, wives, submit yourselves to the husband, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, you know, et cetera, something like that. But then he also goes on to say, husbands, love your wives. And then he defines that love as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. Okay, that model of love is a huge deal. That model of love is all-encompassing, self-sacrificing, not self-serving, is gracious, is kind, is generous, is loving, is patient. That's the model of love that Paul admonishes husbands to manifest toward their wives. And I was having a conversation this week with a friend, and I said, what woman would not want to submit herself to a husband who was actually like Christ, who gave everything for her, who loved her, who did everything that he could to create an environment where she could flourish? And she said, well, yeah. So, you know, too often we just isolate this, wives, submit yourself to your husbands. And we focus on this idea of the husband being the head of the wife. Well, what's interesting about that in this article is that this article, which was written some time ago, actually calls into question our Western interpretation of the word head in that passage. And I thought, this is just pretty interesting. And I offer it not because I'm a Greek scholar, not because I can validate that all this is true, but simply as a way of saying, maybe we should not rush so quickly to take our English translations of things from the Greek that were more nuanced than we expect and infuse them with meaning that comes from our assumptions in our own favor. Because it's very easy for us to do that. Well, that must mean this. Well, maybe. Or maybe it means something else. So I present this not because I know it to be authoritative and definitive. I present this simply from the aspect of maybe we should think a little more closely and investigate for ourselves. So this article was called, Have We Been Misinterpreting the Word Head in Ephesians 5? And so the article starts out by saying the Greek word Paul uses for head in Ephesians chapter 5 is, and I'm going to get this wrong, kephale, which is commonly used to refer to the physical head on one's shoulders. In fact, of the 59 times kephale is found in the New Testament, 44 times it is used of someone's literal physical head. The issue, then, concerns the meaning of kephale when it is used figuratively. Does it, as the English word head, refer to someone who is in charge, as in the head of General Motors? So that's kind of been the assumption all along, but there was a team, Dr. Berkeley and Alvira Michelson had wrote an article in 1981, and they examined and compared how the Jewish translators of the Greek Septuagint had translated Rosh, I didn't get that right either, the Hebrew word for head, into Greek. Their findings completely upended the traditional view and threw many traditionalists into disarray. They discovered that when Rosh was used literally to refer to someone's head, they used kephale. When Rosh was figuratively referred to the source or origin of something, they would again use kephale. However, they discovered that when rosh was used figuratively to refer to a person of authority, the Septuagint translators avoided kephale and used archon or archon. I've got that wrong as well. Ruler, or a similar word. So from that, they then deduce that this shows that when Paul says in Ephesians 25:23 that the husband is the kephale of the wife, his point is not about authority and leadership. If he wanted to establish an authoritarian structure for marriage, he could have easily done so by using words such as archon, despot, or time. Those mean ruler, master, or one of rank and honor. Any of these would have unambiguously communicated the idea of superior rank and authority. Okay, that's very interesting, because that those words were what Paul would have been exposed to as a Pharisee who studied Hebrew. He would know those words. All right, so Paul instead avoids these words and speaks of the husband as kephale, or the source of the wife. And in doing so, he is referring back to Genesis, the account of creation, where instead of creating a separate creature from the ground to make the woman, God took from the side, from the person he had already created from the dust, and built that side into a woman. The popular Jewish commentary, known as the Chumash, says, quote, unlike man's, the woman's body was not taken from the earth. God built one side of the man into a woman, so the single human being became two, thereby demonstrating irrefutably the equality of man and woman. This was important, for ancient pagan teaching said that women had been made from an inferior source than man, which became the basis for male superiority and female subservience. It also became the basis for homosexuality, for as Plato declared, the truly noble soul is masculine and will therefore seek out another male as the object of its love, end quote, because they are alike and of the same substance. I'm getting that out. One moment. Oh, that's my buckles. That's my buckles for my St. Patrick's Day outfit. And more mail, more mail, more mail, more mail, more mail, more mail. Oh, okay, good. Tax return documents. If anything's down here, nope. Okay, good. Okay, so Paul's use of kephale carried connotations of mutuality between the man and the woman, and undermined the ancient argument for homosexuality. It also contributed to Paul's call for commitment and intimacy in the marriage relationship by highlighting, by highlighting the common origin of the sexes. Which actually makes sense, because Paul starts the whole passage by saying, submit yourselves one to another. So he establishes a level of equality by saying that, and then he turns around and says, wives, submit yourselves to your husband, because you are of common type. You are made from common things. You came from man. Ta-da! And so then you have to get in, well, what does that word submit mean? Which is a whole bunch of interpretations of that, I'm sure. Anyways, commentating on the use of kephale in the New Testament, Dr. David Scholar, the late professor of the New Testament at Fuller Seminary Theory, stated that the latest research, quote, does not support the traditionalist or complementarian view of male headship and female submission. He goes on to say the data supports a new understanding of Christ by which men and women are viewed in a mutually supportive, submissive relationship. Etc., etc. Okay. So, is all of that true? Is that what it should be? Frankly, I don't know. But that resonates with me because you do start the passage with submit yourselves one to another. Do start the passage because Paul also exhorts, you do have this exhortation in this passage of a husband loving his wife as Christ loved the church, this huge responsibility to manifest Christ in his marriage. And I just think that if those two things are in play, you know, the rest of the stuff will work it out. It will work itself out. It'll be okay. And I don't think there will ever be a need for a man to be standing there saying, you're supposed to submit to me. I'm going to order you around. You're supposed to do what I tell you to do. I don't see any benefit to that at all. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.